scores!
Ruiz slides! Rollins has won it! They stream out of the dugout! Yeah. Rollins by near third! This game is over!
Second deck walk-off home run! Grand slam, Bryce Harper!
That's what I call hitting season.
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode 558. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Coming up on this episode of the podcast, a rarity. We get to talk about a Phillies series win. They took 2 out of 3 from the Mariners up in Seattle this week, so we'll talk about some of the highlights from that particular series, and I'm going to talk to my good friend Dan Zimborski, senior writer for Fangraphs, in just a few minutes. We'll talk about the Phils, and we'll talk about some other teams around Major League Baseball. Who are the surprise teams? Who are the most disappointing teams? Are the Phillies among them? We'll get to all that stuff coming up. We'll do a quick preview of their upcoming series against the Dodgers as well this weekend. So lots to get to on this episode of the podcast, plus our stat of the week, which is always a ton of fun. So the Phillies take 2 out of 3 from the Seattle Mariners. They move to 14-17 here on the season, and they are 6.5 games behind the Mets in the National League East, tied with the Miami Marlins at 14-17, half a game behind the Braves at 15-17, as the Mets have gone 6-4 in their last 10, the Phillies 4-6. The Phillies have the second best run differential in the NL East at plus 10. Of course, the Mets at plus 33. So still some work to do, obviously, to bridge the gap between the Phils and the Mets here in the National League East. The big stars here in Seattle, Rhys Hoskins and Jean Segura. Hoskins finally getting hot after hitting a lot of balls hard this year without a lot to show for it. He hit 3 home runs in 3 days. And Johnny Heller noted that since 2019, the Phils are 48-17. When Rhys Hoskins goes yards. That's pretty awesome. He had a grand slam in the series finale here on Wednesday that accounted for all 4 of the Phillies' runs in their 4-2 victory. And Todd Zielecki noted this in a story before the game on Wednesday. Hoskins' batting average is 37 points lower than his expected batting average, and his slugging percentage is 78 points lower than his expected slugging percentage. And we talked about this a little bit with Rhys Hoskins here in the early going. I know on the last episode of Hittin' Season, there were a few games in that series against the Mets where he struck out in some really key spots, and those are glaring. That's not a matter of bad luck. But we have also talked about Rhys Hoskins with a bunch of fly balls this year that, under normal circumstances, in normal years when you're not dealing with a deadened baseball, normally leave the park. And so Rhys Hoskins probably would have another home run or two in a normal season, would probably have another couple of extra base hits in a normal season. And finally, Hoskins is starting to see some results from hitting the ball hard. I think one of the things that's important to note is that he has been hitting the ball hard. His hard hit percentage coming into the game on Wednesday, up 5.1% over last year. He's hitting the ball hard in 51% of his batted balls are considered hard hit, according to StatCast. That's 21st out of 184 players in Major League Baseball right now, according to StatCast. So he's been hitting the ball hard and just has not had a lot to show for it here so far this season. In Seattle, the ball went over the fence 3 times, once per game in the 3-game series, and he joined a long list of Phillies hitters who had a good time in the series opener, winning a laugher, and then, of course, in the middle game, losing 5-4, but hit another home run in that one. In the game on Wednesday, Bailey Falter came through in a huge spot for the Phillies, making a spot start, called up from the minors, went 4 2/3 innings. Again, he's still being stretched out because he started off the season in the bullpen, went down to AAA a couple of weeks ago to start getting stretched out as a starter, and the fact that he almost got them through 5 is outstanding. Just gave up 1 run on the day, 5 hits, 4 strikeouts, no walks, and that is the key for Bailey Falter. He's got some funky stuff. Can he command it? On Wednesday, he did command it and lowered his ERA to 3.75. Got a big assist from the Phillies bullpen in this game. Sir Anthony Dominguez finished off the 5th and then pitched the 6th for the Phillies. And then you had Jose Alvarado gave up a run, but Jeurys Familia and Corey Knebel finished off the game. Another 4-out save for Knebel. Outside of that, that implosion against the Mets last week, Corey Knebel has been outstanding as this team's closer. Pretty rock steady. So that, of course, that blown save hurts, but he's been very, very good. The other big star, Gene Segura, and he is on a tear right now. In the midst of a 9-game hitting streak, he hit 2 home runs in this series. On the season, he's now hitting 299 with a 364 on base and a 474 slugging percentage. He has a weighted runs created of 141 with 5 homers and the 5th highest OPS among all second basemen this year at 839. He's on track to make an all-star team this year if he keeps this up. And I was talking about StatCast's hard hit rate and talking about that with Rhys Hoskins. You know who has had the largest increase in hard hit rate from last year? It's Gene Segura. It's up 17.5% over last season. So Gene Segura has been just smoking the ball all season long. And is among the league leaders in hard hit percentage and was doing that in Seattle with regularity this week. A couple of Phil's notes here. Matt Vierling was sent down to AAA so Bailey Falter could be called up. And so I know during the spring, everybody got very excited about Matt Vierling because he did perform well when he came up at the end of the 2021 season. But he just reminded me so much of Aaron Altair that I was down on Matt Vierling's ability to hold down the center field job. And when the Phillies didn't sign Starling Marte, and then you realized that they weren't going to trade for a guy like Brian Reynolds or Cedric Mullins, that was always a pipe dream. And then they didn't make a deal for Tampa's Kevin Kiermaier, which by the way, I don't know if anybody has been checking on Kevin Kiermaier's stats for the Tampa Bay Rays, but if you think what the Phillies have had in center field is a black hole, you should really check and see what exactly it is Kevin Kiermaier is doing. He's hitting 176 with a 238 on base and a 311 slugging percentage for a 69 OPS plus. So it's essentially what Matt Vierling was giving you, but Matt Vierling you could send down to AAA. Kevin Kiermaier you have to keep on your roster. And so, yes, they could have gone and gotten Starling Marte early in the offseason, but decided to go Schwarber-Castellanos. And, you know, we'll be arguing whether or not that was a great decision. But the Phillies center field position is still kind of a mix and match, gobbledygook. Odubel Herrera is hitting well, but he's really doing a lot of chasing outside the strike zone. I feel that the Odubel Herrera implosion is right around the corner. But the Matt Vierling as starting center fielder hype was really just a lot of that. It was a lot of Phillies executives, Phillies fans, people on the team trying to convince themselves that Matt Vierling was going to be the answer in center field. And he's never been that kind of a prospect. And he can still be that someday, but it was getting tough to watch him play. So Vierling will go down to AAA and he'll get a lot. He'll be back. I'm sure he'll be back this season at some point. But the dude was hitting 170 with a 259 on base and a 213 slugging percentage. A 213 slugging percentage in 54 plate appearances. It was never a good idea to go into the season with him as the starter. Of course, it was not supposed to be that way because it was supposed to be him and Odubel Herrera splitting time. Odubel Herrera got hurt, so then it was just Matt Vierling until Mickey Moniak started to arrive on the scene in the spring, and then it was Mickey Moniak's job until Mickey Moniak got hit with a pitch in his final at-bat of the spring, and then it became Matt Vierling's job again, and now it's Odubel Herrera and Roman Quinn out in center field splitting some time until Mickey Moniak is back, and I don't really know what the situation is going to be for Moniak when he comes back because Odubel Herrera has had some production here so far this season. Again, I don't think it'll continue, but I would love to see Mickey Moniak take that job back. Here's my nightmare concern with Mickey Moniak is that he comes back, he struggles having not played for 4 to 6 weeks. And at this point, he's at the 4-week mark. So we're still a couple of weeks away probably from him coming back. Earlier in the week, we heard that he's doing some light baseball activities. He's swinging lightly, but he's not ready to return to game action just yet. So it looks like it's going to be on the 6-week time frame here. And my worry is that he comes back and looks like the old Mickey Moniak. And then we never know what would have happened had he started the season coming off of that insane spring that he was having. I hope I'm wrong about that. That's my pessimistic nature. That's my worry with Mickey Moniak is that he comes back, he's not very good. He gets sent back down to the minors, and we never know what would have been if Mickey Moniak doesn't get hurt. But we can hope that I'm wrong about that. Do want to talk about Bryson Stott a little bit, because Bryson Stott is back at the big league level, subbing for Didi Gregorius. I'm surprised we haven't seen more Johan Camargo. I want to see Stott out at shortstop. I think the only way he's going to get better is to see major league pitching, because down in AAA, he was mashing. He was hitting the ball really well, and he's come up and he's continued to struggle. And what he's really struggled with, and I think Matt Winkleman mentioned this on Twitter, and that was one of the things that made me look this up, the fastball. Bryson Stott is struggling against major league fastballs, and major league pitchers know it. They're just feeding him a steady diet of heaters because he can't hit it with any authority. He's seeing fastballs, this is insane for a major league hitter, 61% of the time. Like, pitchers are just pumping fastballs one after the other, and he's hitting 143 against them this year. 143 against fastballs with an expected batting average of 262. Those numbers should be... The batting average against fastballs should be well over 300 with an expected batting average of probably in the 400s. That's generally speaking, a good major league hitter will do that against fastballs. It's the straight ball. That's the one you're supposed to be looking for to get ahead in the count and gear up for a fastball. So far, he's just not been able to do that. But I do think he needs to be at the big league level in order to get better at this. You're not going to get better at hitting a big league fastball until you see more of them. And he still does have good plate discipline. It's not as good as it has been throughout his minor league career, but that is a plus of his game, and he seems like a guy you can stick at the bottom of the order, hope he plays, makes all the plays at shortstop, maybe makes a couple above-average plays defensively, and learns how to hit a big league fastball. I'd still rather see him in there than Didi Gregorius. I think Bryson Stott is the guy for right now. Johan Camargo has cooled off, and so I get the feeling Stott will learn to hit a major league fastball. And then, of course, it'll be a matter of adjusting to the breaking balls once teams realize that Bryson Stott's learned how to hit the fastball. All right, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Dan Zimborski, senior writer for Fangraphs, about the Phils, and we'll take a look around Major League Baseball as well. We'll do that coming up next here on Hittin' Season. Well, joining me to talk about the Phils, and we'll talk a little bit about what's going on around Major League Baseball. We'll look at some of the more interesting teams in the league, and I want to get Dan's thoughts on what teams he think have been the most surprising and disappointing so far here in the early going of this 2022 season. Dan Zimborski, senior writer for Fangraphs and the father of Zips Projections. Follow him on Twitter at DZimborski. Dan, welcome back to Hittin' Season. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. How are you, John?
Doing great. It's always great to talk to you and talk a little Phils with you. And, you know, when we stretch our legs a little bit, walk around the majors. I do want to start here with the local nine, because the Phillies won their third series of the season here as we are on May 11th, a little bit later in the season. I thought we'd get the third series win, but they took 2 of 3 against the Mariners, and now they have to go to Los Angeles for a 4-game series. I guess just generally speaking, are you surprised by the Phillies' slow start to the season?
Well, I mean, you could say that they are underperforming their Pythagorean record a bit, so it's not quite as bad as it looks. And usually I'm the note of pessimism, so I might actually be less pessimistic than you at this point. I think generally speaking, they're playing okay ball generally. Obviously, that's not across the board, and there are problems here and there. But I don't really think they're actually playing that badly. I think it's an okay team. I think the problem right now is mostly a math one, where the Mets are, and that's kind of a problem for everyone in the division.
Yeah, and the Phillies are not the only team in the East that are struggling right now. Of course, the Atlanta Braves are off to a slow start. The Marlins got off to a little bit of a hot start there, but they've cooled off a little bit. And you're right, the Mets are just running away with this division, and they're not doing it. I don't think the Mets are doing it by blowing people away. The Phillies have had, I think, 3 series now against the Mets, and they've lost all 3 series. The Mets haven't swept them in any of these series yet, and the Phillies have been in a lot of these games, but it just feels like this season so far, Dan, has been doing just enough to lose every single time out there. Like I look at the overall rankings for the different areas of this Phillies team. The Phillies are 13th in terms of total wins above replacement, according to Fangraphs, with their starting rotation. You look at their offense, they're near the top. When comparatively speaking, in just about every category, they are the maybe the best offense in the National League and a top 5 offense in all of baseball. And even their bullpen has been really good lately. They're 10th in FWAR in the bullpen with it's a high ERA of 4.19, but the FIP is low. The expected ERA is lower than it should be. I mean, it hasn't been, you know, aside from that one awful blown save against the Mets a couple of days ago, they've been pretty solid. They had a good series against Seattle. So it's really hard for me to put my finger on. It just seems like every night there's one aspect that is going wrong just enough to cost them a victory. And that just has kind of been a continuing trend. And I think as Phillies fans, it's hard for us to separate these seasons and look at 2022 and the problems of 2022 and say, oh yeah, it's different from what we've seen in previous years.
Yeah. Well, obviously it's not ideal, but it's better to do just enough to lose than to overachieve in losing. Like the Reds, they're doing way more than they need to lose games. I'd rather be in the position where I'm doing just enough to lose than being than excelling in that department.
No, that's fair. And you figure if that's the case, if that's the way things are going, then things are going to turn around. And you mentioned the Pythagorean win-loss record. The Phillies probably should have a better record than they do right now. I tweeted out some numbers earlier today, just looking at how some of the Phillies hitters whose numbers haven't been that great, they're you know, batted, their hard hit percentage is way up. They're hitting a lot of line drives. I mean, offensively, it feels like it's been a disappointing start to the season. But when you look at this lineup, do you look at this lineup as a lineup that's underachieved so far this year?
I don't know. I mean, they're fifth in the NL in offense. That's about probably where I saw them. Obviously, I think there's a little more you can go a little higher than that, obviously. But you look at the lineup and like, who is really playing poorly? Now you can say like Real Muto isn't at his normal levels, but the decline in offense around the league kind of camouflages that, so to speak. It makes starts look worse than they are. Like as I talk about this, you know, Rhys Hoskins has a 716 OPS, which isn't exactly what you want from a first baseman most of the time, but that's still an OPS plus above 100 in baseball this year. I mean,
And he's really hot in the Seattle series. He finally those hits. I mean, you look at the Rhys Hoskins numbers specifically. He's been among the league leaders in hard hit percentage this year. He's been among the league leaders in line drive percentage this year. He's had a few instances in some big spots where he's had some strikeouts, which is just part of the price of Rhys Hoskins. But you know, we were hard on him last week, and then he comes into the Seattle series and hits three homers in three straight games, including the grand slam here on Wednesday that accounted for the only four runs of the game. So a lot of his numbers really got boosted here in these last 3 days, and that's also something that happens early in the season.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like who's hitting poorly? Matt Vierling. It's like, who thought Matt Vierling would be a hitter?
And he's in AAA now. Yeah, exactly.
So it's. I don't think the offense is necessarily a problem. I think it's a math problem just because of where the Mets are. Now, there's always that kind of point of the season where you expect the Mets to Mets it up at some point, some horrifying mess that they find themselves into, because that is the epitome of the Mets. I mean, but they've done it without Jake DeGrom.
Right.
So the question is, do they build enough of a cushion before they get to the LOL Mets point that usually happens sometimes in July? But right now, when we're speaking, it's like a 7-game lead over everyone in the division. But luckily for the Phils, there is an extra wild card.
And I guess that's the thing too, is we have to remember there is an extra wild card, and there are other teams. The National League West right now is absolutely absolutely stacked. Could see all three wild cards come out of the West, for crying out loud. You know, that's really how, I mean, probably not, but that's how things are going out there in the NL West right now. And the Brewers are really head and shoulders above everybody else in the NL Central. Although I look at that Brewers team and I don't think to myself, that's a juggernaut, right? You know, I mean, I think you see the Dodgers, and then I think you still kind of see everybody else right now. Is that generally the hierarchy? I think the Dodgers are still head and shoulders above everybody else.
I think so. I think that's accurate. The Dodgers are a very well built team. They have a lot of depth. They have a lot of minor league talent, so they have reinforcements. It's a really good team. And the Brewers are funny. I mean, they have an OPS at 710, and they're leading the NL in runs scored. Again, 2022 baseball.
Yeah. I do want to ask you about the offense around baseball, because is this something we think is going to turn around when the warmer weather rolls around? And a team that's built like the Phillies are, a team that's built to hit home runs, how do they survive in an environment that is in which offense is suppressed around baseball? I guess there's a lot of teams asking themselves that question.
Well, that is very tricky. I would, you know, give way to Dr. Meredith Wills on this because she does the most examination of baseballs.
Great.
And she thinks that in a very baseball way that their attempts to increase consistency has led to a less consistent ball. I think this is too little offense. And the thing is, baseball isn't suppressing home runs. They're suppressing everything. And I think that's a huge problem when you have a lot of games where nothing is really happening. And for the Phillies, two of their biggest, you know, they picked up Kyle Schwarber, who is a very power-reliant player. Nick Castellanos, not to the same degree. But, you know, to pick up offensive guys and have the ball like this, it's like, you know, investing in a stagecoach company in 1890 and thinking, oh, this car thing will just work itself out.
Yeah.
Because where are you going to get all this oil from? Horses people just have.
Right. No, and that's very true. I think one of the things that, you know, when you talk about the offense being suppressed and what Major League Baseball is trying to do with the baseballs by making it harder to hit home runs, like I can see the wheels churning inside Rob Manfred's head. Well, you know, we deaden the balls, we make it harder to hit home runs. We turn a lot of these would-be home runs into fly balls on the warning track, and that's going to convince hitters to stop trying to hit home runs all the time, and maybe they'll start to hit more singles and doubles and triples. But then it fails to take into account not even defensive shifting, which I would be personally happy to see defensive shifting go away, but I don't even know that so much of the offensive suppression on balls in play even has to do with extreme defensive shifting so much. It's just that there's so much more information about every hitter and knowing exactly where to place your fielders, especially in the outfield, so that you can, I can't tell you how many times I've seen somebody hit a rocket out into left center field, which traditionally would have been a gapper, and there's a guy just standing right there. You know, it's happening a lot more in baseball, and I don't know how you fix that. You know, I don't know how you encourage players to play small ball, where you get the running Redbirds of the mid 80s again. I mean, that kind of baseball is exciting in some ways, but, you know, I remember watching the 1985 and 1987 Cardinals, and some of those games were tough to watch.
Yeah, I think a fundamental problem is that you can change the ball, but you're not really changing the incentives and the skills and the things that teams can do to defend against hitters. So it's a very pitcher-friendly environment right now. I'd like to see them get a little wackier with experimentations in the minors. One of my things I'd love to see them do in the Atlantic League, I'd love to see 88-foot base paths. The shorter distance between bases, yeah, the more incentive there is to put balls in play. It goes back to a lot of what we talked about. I don't know if we specifically talked about this, me and you, but the general during the labor negotiations, is that teams act a certain way because the financial incentives incentivize them to act a certain way. And unless you change those things, the incentives, you're not going to have a quick fix. You can have, like, you know, increased bonus pools and higher minimum. But right now, if you can't get in and change the incentives for teams to tank and for small market teams not to invest, you're not going to change the basic structure on the ground. And right now, you know, offense is largely, I talk a lot about it being almost like a video game meta. It's the meta has been solved in a lot of ways at what makes a good offense, how to get hitters out. And it would be nice to see it shake up somehow. I'm not quite sure what they need to do for that, but I don't think it's a situation where the weather is just going to make everything better, because this is well below previous Aprils.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I think there are still some teams that are managing to hit the ball over the fence, the Yankees for one. It does feel, watching this Phillies offense, as if they've been incredibly inconsistent. But when you look at all of the data, they have proven to be one of the better offenses in baseball this year. It just doesn't feel like it. And as the Phillies enter this weekend series against the Dodgers, four games against the best team in baseball right now on the road, there's not a great chance the Phillies are going to make up ground on the Mets this weekend. I think if the Phillies get out of Los Angeles with a split, they should be doing cartwheels, frankly. And I guess the question too is, before the Seattle series, the hot seat on around Joe Girardi, a lot of conversation among Phillies fans and, of course, on talk radio and all that stuff really is centering around Girardi's job. And Dave Dombrowski does not sound like a guy who's ready to make a switch. But I wonder how far would you allow Joe Girardi, or how, I guess the better question is, how hot do you think his hot seat is if the Phillies are still, you know, 3, 4, 5 games under 500 in another month or so?
I think the thing is how if they're still losing in a month, the question becomes, how are they losing? If they're just generally playing well and just losing close games, it's hard to really blame the manager for that. I mean, Girardi would not have been my hire in the first place. But, you know, once you have him, it's like, okay, so you liked him a month ago. What has happened in this month to change your mind about him? Mm-hmm. And I don't really see him being the problem anymore. I saw Kapler being the problem. I think that, you know, some of the Phillies' problems in recent years have been self-inflicted, but actually this season it feels like the least self-inflicted problem of most. I know we've talked about this in the past, about some of the off seasons where they kind of keep the band together for another album instead of, you know, exploring new things. But I don't think his seat is too hot. I think that there are other managers who should worry a little more.
Let's talk some non-Philly stuff here for just a few minutes. I think the Angels game on Tuesday night was just absolutely wild. Of course, you had the young rookie left-hander for them, Reed Detmers, throwing a no-hitter, only allowed one base runner in that game. Just a really awesome performance by a young left-hander. And then you have Anthony Rendon with Brett Phillips pitching. So you had a position player pitching, and so Anthony Rendon comes up there, and he says, "You know what? You know, we're up 10-0 here. Let me hit left-handed." And Anthony Rendon, in his first ever at bat, left-handed in the majors, swats a two-run home run over the right center field fence. I mean, first of all, how good are Major League Baseball players so that a guy could come up and do that? But, you know, second of all, what do you think was the more interesting part of that evening, the no-hitter or the left-handed home run from Rendon? Because I think it was the dinger.
Yeah, you could actually say the dinger was certainly the most fun part of the night. Of course, it was against Brett Phillips, who is a non-pitcher, and it seemed more fair to bat from the wrong side against a batter pitching, like some sort of justice. What the weird thing is, what makes me the happiest is that nobody was whining after the game about unwritten rules. You didn't see, like, Brett Phillips going, he showed me up, he tried. Or, you didn't see, you know, Kevin Cash going, "The Angels were ahead and they kept trying to play baseball well. Me, me, me." That's kind of what happens in a lot of these things.
Yeah, and it does.
And Brett Phillips acted like it was pretty cool. I like when baseball remembers that it's fun, because that was fun. Baseball sometimes tries to indicate that they're not fun in any way and make sure everybody knows it, that baseball is serious business.
We're very serious.
There's no laughing or smiling in baseball.
No, you're not a professional. You have to act like you've been here before, Dan.
Yeah. Oh, you're smiling. Well, you know what? Joe Cronin would roll over at his grave and then beat you up. Like, okay.
Stab you in the neck with a cleat if you.
Yeah, Ty Cobb would have nothing to do with it. He'd kill your family.
He would. No, but he would. And see, that's the problem. We've moved on from Ty Cobb, which I think is a good thing. But I just feel like the Angels right now have this team of destiny thing going on. I mean, you have the two best players in the sport. That really should give you a leg up, you know, with Shohei Ohtani and Mike Trout.
I thought you meant Taylor Warden, Mike Trout.
Well, I was going to say, and now you've got this former first-round pick out of nowhere, Taylor Ward, who is leading the American League in every one of the triple slash categories. He's got a 1.7 FWAR. You've got Anthony Rendon hitting left-handed home runs. You got these kids throwing no-hitters, and they just look like Noah Syndergaard's pitching pretty well for them so far. I mean, they look like a team that is finally going to get Mike Trout into the postseason. Is that how you're feeling with them right now?
It's looking that way. They are playing really well. I think that Ward's improvement, like, I don't think he's going to be an 1100 OPS guy by the end of the season, but there are reasons to like him. I actually wrote a piece about him a few weeks ago, so that's weirdly topical and and helpful for me to remember to actually plug something I did at some point. I never remember that.
That's fantastic. Yeah, we got to make sure we do that more often.
Yeah, I always forget that. But, you know, it was always the problem was for the Angels is you start with Trout and Ohtani. Your job is basically to build an 80-win team around them. Not a great team, just an 80-win team. It's like, can you build the Chicago Cubs? I mean, not this year, obviously, or last year. I'm just trying to think of a team that I kind of think of as an 80-win team. I guess Cleveland. Cleveland's a good team to think of as an 80-win team.
There you go.
Can you build the Guardians, who cost nothing? And largely this year, they have found players around them, those two, that don't suck. And that's been their basic problem, that they can't find players that don't suck. And some of the players that do, they just play out there because whatever. Sure, Albert Pujols hasn't been good in 7 years. Let's just keep throwing him out there because he gets some milestones. Justin Upton, I mean, well, he's not good, but he's in his 30s and we pay him a lot. So that's worthy of a spot. They've kind of improved at that. I was really happy actually to see them kind of jettison Upton, even though they were paying him this year.
Yeah.
And they've been fairly creative. They've been looking at Brandon Marsh, Taylor Ward, Jack Mayfield. I hate to say I like this team because
I know,
the Angels,
right? Because that's when they're going to start losing, when you admit that.
Yeah. And they kind of have one of the crappiest owners in the game.
Right.
But this team does look pretty good right now.
They are fun, and there's nobody more fun in baseball to watch than Ohtani. Which team has been the biggest disappointment so far? I don't think it's been the Phillies, but the Phillies are certainly among the biggest disappointments. I think MLB.com did like a poll of baseball executives. They were asking this question. The Phillies were certainly on the list, but they weren't at the top. Which team do you think has been the biggest disappointment so far?
I think, to an extent, the White Sox have been, but they've been playing better the last week, so it's not really as much of a problem. I would say probably the Red Sox have been disappointing. Mm. They're behind the Orioles right now, and you don't really want to be behind the Orioles.
No.
It feels like that some of the things they didn't really finish this offseason, they just went into the season saying, okay, Jackie Bradley Jr. is magically going to hit again. The depth in the rotation isn't as great as it could have been, although they have been hit by a lot of injuries at once. But the Red Sox have certainly been on that disappointing category. I think you have to say the Reds, just because even though I don't think anyone expected them to be good after trading half the team, I don't think they expected this, where they were winning.
You didn't expect the Cleveland Spiders.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't expect that. So I would definitely say them. Maybe Detroit to an extent. Not because I thought Detroit was going to be great, but I thought their offense would be better than this, and their offense has been absolutely terrible this year. Torkelson hasn't been great. Really, nobody in that lineup is hitting except for Austin Meadows. But those I think are the most disappointing teams.
What about Atlanta?
Oh, obviously, I guess Atlanta should be on that list simply because they are below 500, and I mean they do have Acuña back, which is always a plus.
Yeah. And he's been hitting well since he came back too.
But Charlie Morton's looked really old. I mean, his command has been weird. And Max Fried, of course, has been terrific. As Kyle Wright, I think that the Braves are going to turn it around. But the question, of course, is the same with the Phillies. Do they turn it around soon enough to make the Mets uncomfortable when the Mets do something very funny?
And I think we are all eagerly anticipating the Mets doing something bad and dumb and stupid and going on some kind of losing streak.
Yeah, and if they don't, fate will just find something wacky and make it happen.
Right, exactly. But they do look like a team that just kind of just kind of has it this year. But felt the same way in 2007. So I'm just gonna watch some YouTube videos of that season. Last thing for you here, that AL East, you mentioned the Red Sox are behind the Orioles in that division, but you've got three powerhouses in that division with the Yankees, the Rays, and the Blue Jays. And then over in the NL West, of course, you have the Dodgers, the Giants, and the Padres. Which division is better?
I think the AL East, I think the third best AL East team, probably the Rays, is better than the Giants, although I'll probably get people angry at me for that. I think that probably by the end of the season, both the Diamondbacks and the Rockies will be safely under 500. I think the Red Sox will be better. I think the AL East is a bit stronger.
It's both are really, really good. And I agree. Yeah. I think Boston will rebound a little bit. Colorado is a, you know, they're a fraud for sure. They're hitting the ball pretty well, but you know, the Giants just keep surprising. I'm waiting for that team to fall apart or to go through a losing streak. And they just keep finding a way to do it. That it's just been a great marriage between Gabe Kapler and whatever it is they're doing analytically out in San Francisco. That they just keep figuring out ways to win.
Jock Peterson has been terrific.
One
of the things, I mean, they have gotten some pretty terrific pitching.
Yeah.
Of course, I mean, Carlos Rodon was a terrific acquisition.
Yeah, great signing.
The rest of baseball kind of has to kind of kick themselves for not risking more because, yeah, he was injured last year, but he was also really terrific. And the contract was not really a huge one. I mean, right. 244, you can't think of something more spicy than that.
Well, they're gonna, I mean, you know,
that's what the Giants paid Tim Lincecum after he was already done to come back for 2 years.
It was a great contract, and that's one guy I wanted the Phillies, if they had any extra money to throw around. I was hoping they would grab him, but he's doing really well for San Francisco, and if he was in Philadelphia, the ERA would be over five. So that's the sign we live under. Listen, folks, make sure you're checking out everything Dan is doing over at Fangraphs. Terrific stuff. You know, check out his timeline. He's got all his articles there at D Zimborski. Check out the Zips projections, of course, to get your latest info on all of that over at Fangraphs. Dan, thanks so much for coming back on Hitting Season, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, John. We always have fun.
All right, well, quickly, let's preview this upcoming four-game series against the Dodgers. The Dodgers, of course, are on an absolute roll. Clearly the best team in baseball. Some good news for the Phillies. Zach Wheeler is back from the COVID IL, and he will make his start on Thursday. So the Phillies at least have their ace back in the rotation. It'll be Zach Wheeler against left-handed pitcher Tyler Anderson in the game on Thursday, the series opener on Friday. It'll be the guy who's been the most consistent for the Phillies so far this year, Kyle Gibson, against a rejuvenated Clayton Kershaw. On Saturday, left-hander Ranger Suarez will take on a guy who has been absolutely unhittable pretty much since he came to the major leagues, Walker Buehler. Tough matchup for the Phillies. And then on Sunday, Aaron Nola will take on Julio Urias. There should be some good pitching matchups. That Dodgers lineup just continues to be a beast. I don't know how the Phillies are going to get through this, but listen, they've got their four best starters. I got to say, Zach Wheeler, Kyle Gibson, Ranger Suarez, Aaron Nola. They've got their four best going up against the Dodgers this weekend. So you're keeping your fingers crossed for a split here. If they can come out of LA 2-2 and you know, finish up this trip to Seattle and Los Angeles with a 4-3 record, I'll take that. I will absolutely take that every day of the week. So that's what's coming up here as the Phillies get ready to take on the Dodgers in Los Angeles this weekend. All right, time for your stat of the week. It's a Rhys Hoskins stat. Rhys Hoskins, in his career, since he debuted in August of 2017, has 252 extra base hits and 330 walks. Extra base hits and walks. That is Rhys Hoskins' game. There are only two players in baseball with as many extra base hits and walks since Rhys Hoskins came into the league. Bryce Harper, his teammate, with 260 extra base hits, eight more than Rhys, and 389 walks. And Freddie Freeman, with 280 extra base hits and 335 walks. The only players with as many extra base hits and walks since Rhys Hoskins' debut in August of 2017. I don't know what Rhys Hoskins' long-term future is with this team. I want him to be a part of it. I want him to be able to be productive enough for the Phillies to consider keeping him around. I think the odds are better that at some point next year, Rhys Hoskins is someplace else. But as up and down as he is, largely speaking, overall, he is a productive first baseman in Major League Baseball, and he doesn't need to be the guy in this lineup, as we've talked about before. All right, folks, that's going to do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. My thanks again to Dan Zimborski for coming on the podcast. Just a reminder, folks, please leave a 5-star rating and a review at Apple Podcasts if you haven't done so already. If you leave that rating and review, I'll read it on the next episode of the podcast. And tell your friends about the Good Fight podcast feed. We've got lots of great podcasts, The Dirty Inning, Continued Success, and we've also got a good Hittin' Season Patreon where we have some bonus material there. We do movie reviews, we do bonus podcasts, lots of other fun stuff there. Go to patreon.com/hittin'season and sign up on one of the tiers we have over there to get all of that fun content extra. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time here on Hittin' Season.